All right, welcome back to another episode of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson, and tonight we're here with, I always say tonight, but you're listening to it whenever you're listening to it. Tonight we're here with two celebrities, my lands, and hey, do you guys notice I use Mormon swear words now that I've dropped the adult words? Golly.
Whatever happened to, you need to bring back the Mormon swear jar, whatever it is you used to have.
Geez, I had to take out a loan. I had to add 6 months to my student loans because of that thing. Well, welcome, gentlemen. Of course, a lot of stuff going on these days. You've got a new project. Of course, it was Mormon Leaks. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it still kind of is.
But you're rebranding. You've got a new outlet, right?
I might say it a little differently than that, but yeah.
How would you say it?
Well, okay. So, you know, everybody knows, or at least the majority of your listeners, they know Mormon Leaks, and that's kind of where it all started. We then started this Faith Leaks website, which is Mormon Leaks for every other religion. Yeah. And at the same time that we started Faith Leaks, we started to say, well, you know, maybe we're going to expand this operation beyond Mormonism, or, you know, more than Mormonism, which is kind of what we want. And so we created this umbrella organization that's called the Truth and Transparency Foundation, which is our 501c3 nonprofit, put Mormon Leaks and Faith Leaks under that umbrella. But we continued to publish things. We did that in late 2017, okay? Uh-huh. And we continued to publish things the same way we were doing it with Mormon Leaks, where we were just throwing documents up onto Mormon Leaks with a very basic fact summary of what the document was. And we had some leaks through Faith Leaks, which we did the same thing, right? And then last year, in 2018, towards the end, we started talking about seriously shifting the way we publish our leaks. And we wanted to start actually writing articles about our leaks. And so we redid the Truth and Transparency website, which not a lot of people really knew about, because even though the organization existed, we still kept publishing under Mormon Leaks and Faith Leaks. And so under this new model that we launched in January, we are publishing articles. And the length will vary, by the way, with how big of a leak it is. You know, some articles might just be two paragraphs, you know. And we're still publishing the documents on Mormon Leaks in the wiki, or Faith Leaks if it's a Faith Leaks leak. But we are no longer doing press releases from those sites. We are just publishing the article, and the article will link to the document.
All right. Well, I've been reading. You guys are all over the news right now. I've been reading up, and we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's introduce the all-stars. First of all, Ryan, this was kind of your brainchild, no?
Yeah, first, I mean, sure.
I don't want to steal the thunder from Ethan, but
yeah.
We know who the brains behind the operation is, right?
Well, it's definitely not Ryan.
Yeah. The computer brains definitely. No, look, the reality is I mean, yes, I'm the founder of Mormon Leaks, and, you know, it started with these 15 videos and things like this. A lot of your listeners, you know, they know all about it. But when I wanted to make a website, Ethan basically joined up with me, or I brought him on to join up with me, or very, very early. In fact, he was probably the first person that I officially teamed up with. So I don't want to minimize like how integral Ethan has been in this thing. People know me as the founder of Mormon Leaks because I did start it. And for the first, I don't know, 10 months or so, Ethan was anonymous. So people didn't even know, you know, who he was. They couldn't put a face to the name, or even a name to anything. So, some people don't realize that we've had people come and go from our organization. Ethan and I have been there from basically, I was there day one and Ethan was there day two and a half.
Excellent. So now we're hearing from you. Let's start with Ethan. Ethan, who are you and why should we care?
I don't know that you should care, but, I'm Ethan Gregory Dodge. I'm the technical director of Truth and Transparency. Basically, as Ryan said, I do anything with computers falls under my wheelhouse, I guess you could say. I got started because Ryan, when he released those 15 videos, the source, they weren't given to Ryan in the most secure and anonymous way possible. And I am I'm a digital forensics professional. I catch hackers for a living. So this is the kind of thing that I understand. And I reach out to Ryan. And I said, hey, here, let me help you protect your sources. And that's kind of how it got started. So anything technical, whether it's our server and website up and running or actually protecting our sources, that's my area that I concentrate on.
Don't forget teaching me how to use Twitter.
Yeah, teaching Ryan how to use Twitter, Facebook sometimes as well.
Sometimes, yeah. I'm better at Facebook. I can't stand Twitter.
Oh, I've been drifting back into Facebook to, you know, because of this endeavor after a 2-year hiatus, and I have mixed feelings about that thing. All right, yeah. So Ryan, tell us who you are.
Yeah, I mean Ryan McKnight. I live in Las Vegas, and there were a few serendipitous events, you know, where I was in the right place at the right time, I suppose. I found myself in a position where I thought that maybe I could help in keeping the church honest, really. I mean, that's really what our goal is promoting transparency, truth and transparency in religion. And I decided to pull the trigger. And I wasn't sure how successful it would be, and it's turned out to be pretty successful so far. I guess some people may disagree with that, but I think we're happy with where we're sitting today. I left the church about fall of 2013. So I don't know, 5.5 years ago, and I was just, you know, an anonymous, random ex-Mormon online drifting through the abyss.
You forgot to say angry.
I was angry. Absolutely. If you go and look up my early, Reddit history, it's seething with anger.
Of course.
And, we've all been there. I did get over the angry phase for the most part. I think the only thing that will sometimes still make me angry is when I think about all the tithing money I gave them. That's probably the only anger I have left, but that only rears its ugly head every once in a while, you know, like when I wish I had a bigger house or something like that.
Right. you'll find that every so often the anger will spike again, and that's okay.
Yeah. That, yeah.
You know,
so I was just floating through the internet, you know, and finding solace among my anonymous, you know, compadres, and then was thrust into this position, and it's been fun and it's rewarding. And I hope that we've made a difference.
Well, excellent. So you guys started this Truth and Transparency Foundation, and really it's, in case anybody can't figure out what we're talking about, it's really much like WikiLeaks, where folks can anonymously take official documents or artifacts or whatever they have from the church that I assume you guys verify, and they can clean them up and publish them without being identified. Is that a good summary?
Yeah. And we're expanding that into writing articles, and we are, as time permits, wanting to also write articles about things other than just our leaks that still fall within our mission of promoting truth and transparency in religion. So we are sort of expanding that scope.
So would you guys accept submissions? Sorry, Ethan, would you guys accept submissions from people if they fall in this paradigm of what you're trying to publish?
I think we're definitely open to talking to people. I want to kind of set the right expectations. You know, I don't know that if somebody just like tells us their story, we're going to write a story about it.
Right.
But I definitely want to hear things. And if there's something that is lacking documentation, but I still think I can write a story that holds up to the standards we're seeking, then yeah, we're definitely open to that.
Great. Ethan, you had something?
Yeah, I think the WikiLeaks comparison was pretty good back when we were just concentrating on Mormon leaks. And I think that's what Ryan was hitting on. I really like the label nonprofit newsroom. We're a nonprofit newsroom that specifically focuses on promoting transparency and exposing corruption within religious institutions. And whistleblowing will always be part of our foundation, right? That's how we got our start. And it was obvious the documents that we were releasing were exposing general problems and themes and whatnot of corruption within these religious institutions. And sometimes the media would jump on it and dig a little deeper, but sometimes we wanted to take a story a certain way, but we didn't, maybe we didn't have the time, or maybe it wasn't aligned with our mission. Or, I mean, you know, Ryan and I, we both work full time. We do this in our free time, and we both have young families as well. Right. So anyway, so now we're like Ryan said, we're doing more investigative journalism than we were before.
And a shout out to people like you and others. You know, the church is worth hundreds of billions of dollars. It's got so much money. It can bulldoze over everybody and everything. And I want to underline what you guys are saying. The folks out there doing good work like you two are doing this. You're not making money. It's a side project. It's a, you know, you have to find time, and you guys are a 501c3. So is there a donate? I'm looking at your page. Is there a donate button?
Yeah, people can donate. And, you know, the only way we make money is when we cash the George Soros checks we get every month.
Well, what about the Russians? You have to be getting some from the Russians, right?
The problem is I sometimes make posts on Facebook criticizing Donald Trump. So that kind of dried up, but yeah, no, I mean, listen, we very few people that do the kind of thing that we do make money, and the ones that do make, it's usually minimal. It's usually not a living. And so you really do have to have a passion for it. Maybe even be a glutton for punishment. You know, I don't know, but
of course, but every penny, if somebody wants to throw a little cabbage, you guys away, you would appreciate it.
Yeah.
Truthtotransparency.org/donate. That's where they can do it.
Excellent.
Yeah. Right now, all of our donations, you know, which we obviously publish our financials every year, all the donations go to running the website, or if Ethan and I need to travel on official, you know, Mormon or Truth to Transparency business, which is very rare, you know, it'll be like going to Sunstone or something, you know, that money will cover that cost. We don't pull any kind of a stipend. That I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. The only way it really could is if we were to get like some really big donors and we could make this our full-time job, but I don't, you know, there's no light at the end of that tunnel at this point. So I don't really ever expect that to happen.
Hey, fellas, I give you permission to pull a stipend if you want.
Yeah, we probably could afford maybe a $5 a month stipend, maybe.
As long as it's modest, right?
Take each other out to the Sonic or something. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so you already mentioned the videos. Let's go back to the beginning and start with the videos. That was your first major, I don't know what we call it, your first major drop on the media.
Yeah, it was the first time that my name was out there. Like, I had a small role in the November policy in 2015, but it was more of a behind-the-scenes role, and basically only people on Reddit knew about it, because John DeLynn kind of gave me credit on Reddit as being his source. But I wasn't the original source. I had a source, but my source wanted to stay anonymous, and I didn't mind that my name was out there. So,
so just to make clear, not everybody follows Mormonism as closely as, say, we all do. The November policy came out, like you said, in the fall of 2015, was when the church basically said, hey, we invite every child and man and woman to come to Jesus unless your daddies are gay.
I like that description. Yeah, I'm sure that's going to ruffle
some people. Or mommies are gay.
Yeah.
We'll hear that. But yeah, no, it is really about as bad as what you just said. So it's a horrible policy. I don't know who, you know, signed off on this, but it a horrible blunder on their part.
I think I know, but it's so strange, because it goes against, it's so defensive and so transparently crazy, which is, you know, you guys hinted at your videos and the other stuff you show, you're exposing corruption. I get what you're saying. I've watched a lot of the stuff you guys have put out. To me, it shows more buffoonery than corruption, you know.
Well, but I mean, I think when it comes to at least the Mormon church, and this probably applies to a lot of different religions, I think the buffoonery is the corruption. That's the way the corruption manifests itself.
That's
because
true.
You know, they put this front on to the average tithe payer that there is no buffoonery going on, when there actually is buffoonery going on. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
So, yeah. But you know, it's amazing. When that November policy came out, John, and I, you know this already, but it was one of the reasons why that thing had so much legs in the media was because it didn't just piss off the ex-Mormons. Right. It shook believing Mormons, many of them, to their core. And I can't tell you how many people over the years, including in the moment, contacted me and have contacted me since, telling me that was the beginning of the end for them.
I'm one of those. I was still active when that policy was leaked. And I don't know that it was as big of a shelf item for me as other people, but it definitely had a profound and big impact on my orthodoxy.
Yeah, it's this stuff is strange. Having been around a long time, the church does something like this about every 5 years and throws another group mm-hmm. of people out of the church, whether it's Prop 8 or who knows what, the ERA. It's always taking these moves, and I don't know. I guess that's what happens when you get led by very old men who are yeah. kind of surrounded by sycophants. Okay.
Well, the bubble is tight, and you see that in the 15 videos, which is what came out. That's what kind of solidified my role in all of this. You know, the people that followed me on Reddit that knew that I was this, you know, quote unquote, the leaker of the November policy would sometimes send me things here and there. And in October of 2016, somebody contacted me through Reddit and got me these videos that they'd been sitting on for years. And I didn't really watch them all. I watched like the 5 minute ones, and you know, they were all very boring. I put them up. And little did I know, there was a bunch of newsworthy revelations in there, even, you know, on a national stage. And so there was huge media coverage. I can't even tell you how many interviews I gave. And it all kind of culminated after a week with a piece in the New York Times with my picture and, you know, a big story. And so, you know, that now that my name was out there, I was really getting bombarded with people contacting me, and I was like, and I could tell anonymity was important. And so I was like, you know, maybe a website is in order. And I don't want to speak for Ethan, but I had major doubts as to whether or not we were actually going to get anything. But you know, Ethan and the people that were working with us behind the scenes did a great job putting that website together. And providing this tool called Secure Drop that's you know, provides the anonymity for sources. And the very first leak that we got was the information on the apostles and the general authorities' pay, which basically solidified the legitimacy of our website and the need for it.
Okay, before we move on to that, let's just give a synopsis of what the videos covered. These were inside baseball sort of corporate meetings where they're talking about what they want to do. Is that right?
Yeah, they're meetings that my understanding is they occur once a week on Mondays. And it's a meeting that is attended by the 12 apostles, plus anybody that they invite that they feel, you know, it's relevant to the information, or, you know, would need to hear the information presented. And the 15 videos that we have, the range of topics is very wide. I mean, there's one video where they talk about, and it's Garrett Gong, who's an apostle now, but at the time he was a 70, and he was briefing the apostles on WikiLeaks, because this was like in 2010 or 11 when WikiLeaks was just sort of making a name for themselves. And he was talking about how WikiLeaks or a WikiLeaks type website could hurt the church, you know, very prophetic in a way. but true to form, these 12 men who are supposed to be, you know, seers and revelators, instead of focusing on this very real threat and well done presentation by Garrett Gong, the only thing they were interested in talking about in the Q&A section of the presentation was speculating on the sexuality of Julian Assange and making sure that Bradley Manning, who later became Chelsea Manning, you know, was actually a confirmed homosexual, was what they called it.
Confirmed.
You know, yeah, they, you know, Oaks, I think it was Oaks, who wondered out loud if Bradley Manning was a confirmed homosexual. And, you know, he went on to say that the reason he wants to know if Julian Assange is also gay is because he's worried that something like WikiLeaks is part of the gay agenda that is out there trying to take down the good religious people of the world and especially Salt Lake City. So there was like silly stuff like that. And there was stuff on medical marijuana where they were comparing marijuana to meth. But, you know, then there was very serious ones like the one with a guy named Gordon Smith, who had just at the time of the video had just left the U.S. Senate. He was a senator in Oregon, served a couple of terms, and he's a Mormon. It was a basically a debriefing after he had just left the Senate. And he was thanking the 12 for all of their help and support and basically said that his office never did anything until the church told them how to act. He even made a joke at one point that there was like a 6-week period where they hadn't heard from the church representatives and his office was at a standstill because they didn't know what to do. He made that joke in the video. So, it was interesting because, you know, he was not a senator in Utah where you could argue that his constituents are Mormon and would be in line with the church. He was a senator in Oregon. So the good people of Oregon were being represented by the LDS Church for a couple of years.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter. Since 1975, Sunstone Magazine has been publishing the best of Mormon thought and experience. And now, Sunstone is also a podcast where you can listen to audible quality recordings of our best articles, essays, stories, and poetry, both new and classic. Come get a taste with our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. We look forward to being a part of your journey.
After these videos, and then of course you started hitting at the pay scale thing, which is one of those revelations that again comes out about every 10 years, and then everyone seems to forget. But this was the latest. Tell me about that one.
Well, Ethan, why don't you tell them about that one?
Yeah. So let's see. We launched on December 16th, and then on like January 3rd or something like that of 2017. We released some pay stubs of President Eyring that were issued back in the 90s, and they gave us some insight into how much, obviously, how much he was making back then and how much he may be making now. But what was really great was that we also got a memo that was addressed to a member of the 70s saying that his living allowance, I believe is what it was called in the memo, was being increased from $114,000 to $120,000. And that was dated in 2014. And so we released that memo and the pay stubs. And then that same day, the church actually made a statement saying that all general authorities are paid a living allowance and that they are all paid the same base allowance, which was pretty cool for them to come out and say that. Get a little bit of confirmation behind something that we leaked after the website launched. I think it might have been our very first.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I don't have any specific information. I've read it before. When you have a corporate executive who has a living allowance, there's many other ways that corporate executives are compensated. They're usually given corporate cars, corporate drivers. They're oftentimes giving a housing allowance above and beyond a living allowance. So I would contend that, you know, even though they're making six figures, that's just a portion of how they're being compensated.
They're definitely making more. And I think the phrase in the memo, there was a phrase in there where they referred to it as a base living stipend.
Right.
And so, yeah, we do know they make more. I mean, we've proved a little bit of that. We had like, for example, we published a memo that was giving the members of the 70 instructions on how to cash in their credit card points. Basically, like these credit cards that they use for all of their church travel that the church is paying for, they get to personally keep those points. And for some of them, that adds up to a lot. They also, and there's other things, you know, out there, obviously, that perks, you know, that we just really haven't been able to prove that I'm fairly certain I know because I've had multiple sources tell me. And, you know, they will often be assigned to some of the for-profit companies as board members or executives, right. And they'll get paid for that kind of stuff as well. So we don't really know what the total compensation is. I think it's, I think, you know, I don't want, you know, the Mormons that I'm sure are going to, tons of them are going to be listening to this. I don't want them to think that we're suggesting that they're being paid too much money. We're not really in that debate. You know, I think you could probably justify all of them to be making in the millions if they were. I don't think they are, but they're probably making somewhere. The top ones are probably making somewhere in the $500,000 or $600,000 range, I would guess, when you put a dollar sign to the entire employment package. And they're probably worth every penny of it from a, you know, from a business standpoint. Our biggest thing when we publish something like that is that we take a very hardline position that no matter how much or how little they make, the tithe payers have a right to know, and the church has an ethical responsibility to inform them of what they're making.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that point. That it's a debate that I've been in many times of the last however many years, that they're actually not compensated as well as they would be if they were in the private sector, in my opinion.
Well, I would disagree with that, but go ahead.
Well, some of these guys come from big companies. Some of these guys are worth tons and tons of money. So, but that being said, it's really hard to make the case to, you know, Maria down in Guadalupe or whatever, who's paying, she makes $500 a year and she pays 50 of that. And because of that, you know, they go without protein oftentimes. When these guys are saying, hey, you know, I took a $7 million pay cut, come work for the church, and I only get $500,000 a year. That's the kind of thing they're trying to hide.
Sure.
Which goes back to me, you know, the whole point, it's about transparency. What's funny is you brought up that the Mormons might be mad at, or angry at us for talking about this, which is really bizarre because we didn't do it. None of us are giving that compensation. You two are just kind of showing what's really happening.
Yeah. And look, I would like to just take a moment. You know, you mentioned this idea that, you know, they're taking pay cuts, or many of them are taking pay cuts, which is a common trope that you hear from Mormons, like, oh, well, you know, hey, they're taking pay cuts, so really they're sacrificing. Here's the problem I have with that, is that while you might be able to find some exceptions where, like, there are a couple of them here and there that literally took pay cuts for the job, let's just start with this. Let's say that they only make $120,000 a year only. Okay. We know they make more. We'll start with that. Do you know any 94-year-old heart surgeons that are making $120,000 a year?
Heart surgeons?
Oh, sure.
They make a lot more than that.
At the age of 90, at the age of 94?
Oh. Yeah, I see what you're saying. So
I want to take that a little step further, right? So obviously there are no heart surgeons. So Nelson is not sacrificing income in his current position.
Right. All right.
Now that's obviously the extreme end because he's the oldest one of them all. But let's take even a younger, very successful, you know, businessman or lawyer, what is it ever. And, you know, he's 55 to 60 years old, maybe even younger than that. And he's getting called into the 70. It's very likely that he's in a position where he can retire, right, if he wanted to. And guess what happens when he's paid, however much it is he's paid by the church? Again, it doesn't even matter the amount. Unless he wants to, he does not have to touch that nest egg that he has built for retirement, which he otherwise would have if he were to retire and enjoy life as opposed to sacrificing it for the church, quote unquote. And so it's not just the fact that they're making $120,000 a year, okay? It's the fact that they're making that money, and all that money that they worked hard to supposedly live out the rest of their life with in retirement, they do not even have to touch.
Right.
And so, again, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but when a Mormon says, and it's usually Mormons that will say this, when a Mormon tries to say, well, they're sacrificing income, it's just really not true in almost any way that you slice it.
Yes, this is true. And I'm thinking about all the different models I can go into. You can go up to Midway, Utah, which is where they all like to retire to, where they build, you know, after a year, years and years in church service, they build $5 million homes, and you start saying, is this what you would expect? Again, if the church wants to take on the prosperity gospel full on, you know, like evangelicals do, then do what you're going to do. But this pretending that they're humble servants and they're not doing it when they're secretly doing it is what irks my ire, is and what makes me glad that you guys are out there doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's fast forward to your next big get. Whatever you want to fill.
Well, in that would probably be the bubble chart. Ethan could talk about that one.
Yeah. So this one's a fun one. We got a PowerPoint slide deck that was shared with some high leaders in the church, and the slide deck was interesting. It was titled Area Business Weekends, and they went into it's just a slide deck, so they didn't go into like great detail. It's just a summary, but it does address how I'm blanking on who was it, Elder Oaks, who went up to Idaho for the Idaho rescue or whatever. Yes. You want to call it.
Yes.
Yeah, Elder Oaks. They talked about how he went, how him going up to Idaho to help the saints up there was what they call an area business weekend. But that's not what's fascinating about this PowerPoint.
Well, though. Ethan, let me just pause you right there, because people are not going to remember this. When he went and did that, which was before we released this PowerPoint, a lot of people speculated that he went up there to address special concerns of the local members, and the church actually issued it. It got so much fervor that the church actually issued a statement that wasn't true.
Right, and
go ahead.
If I'm not mistaken, those saints, those members that they went up to resolve their concerns, those were the remnant followers of Denver.
Yeah, they were addressing a growing problem in the area of people following Denver Snuffer.
And they continue to do this. And of course, I don't know if they're going to slow their roll, but now everybody's recording everything with cell phones. So
we get recordings all the time. The church came out and explicitly said that it was a spontaneous visit, that he just happened to be in the area and decided to get up and talk. And this PowerPoint presentation shows that was actually not true.
Right. So that was an important revelation of the PowerPoint presentation, but that's not what made it viral. There are several aspects that made it viral, but what started it was there was this one slide on there that had a bubble chart, and that's why it's called, you often hear it called the bubble chart. And it has a political spectrum at the bottom. And the title of it is something like things leading people away from the gospel or something I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist of it. And then there's all these bubbles, and some of them are bigger than others, and each one has a word in the center of it. And supposedly these are things that are leading people away from the gospel. Like one of the biggest ones is pornography, right? And that one's like right in the center. There's another one there's one that says secular, right? And that one's kind of off to the left. Right there. I can't remember exactly what they call this one, but it's like your end of days type people, your preppers, right? Like that one's kind of more off to the right there. But then there's also ones that name specific people. John DeLynn had his own bubble, and he was way far off into the left. Denver Snuffer had his own bubble as well, and he was over to the right. Ordained Women was on the very far left. Apparently that's how they see them, and had their own bubble, right? And this was significant because when this was released, Denver Snuffer, John DeLynn, and Kate Kelly, founder of Ordained Women, had all been excommunicated, and they were all had ties to this PowerPoint slide, right? So when I was the first one to see this, and I saw it, and I just busted up laughing. Like I was like, you got to be kidding me. This can't be real, right? Anyway, we ended up releasing it, and like most stuff that the church puts out, the design quality of this was just terrible. Like we easily could have manufactured this, right? Fabricated it and pegged it on the church. But the church the very next day issued us a DMCA takedown request saying that they owned the copyright and that it needed to be taken down. Essentially confirming that it was real, right? That it was theirs, which boggles my mind. I suspect we got it from the intellectual property department of the church. And I suspect that they didn't consult PR before doing it because that was a very dumb PR move. But who knows? Maybe they did.
I think they do this a lot, and most people get scared. And and because I can think probably of four or five cases of people I've known who haven't wanted to, you know, go up against the church. And then those of us who lawyered up and were ready for the fight, they never bothered.
Yeah, and that's actually something
disappointing.
I want to come back to that in a second because we've had a recent experience with Watchtower, the governing organization of the Jehovah's Witnesses, that's very similar.
Oh yeah.
At the time we were hosting our documents with a third party, we didn't have our own server, our wiki hosting our documents quite yet, because we just kind of got our website out the door. And that third party, Doctroid, took down the PowerPoint, and then a week later I had our server up in Switzerland running with the wiki, and then our attorney at the time, his name was Mark Rondassa. He's a very renowned, well-known First Amendment lawyer, and he basically told the church, nope, it's not coming down. They have every single right to publish this. His response was very colorful. I mean, he didn't cuss in it or anything, but he basically called the church out in a number of ways, and in a very unprofessional, but untypical. Anyway, not typical way for an attorney, right?
Eccentric.
Yeah, there's a good word. Anyway, Rondassa's response combined with the Streisand effect made this thing go viral, right? That story was picked up by so many news outlets, including the Washington Post.
You know, right? here's a fun little tidbit that probably I don't think we've ever said in an interview. It just so happened, total coincidence, that the day that we released this letter, which was like, I don't know, 2 or 3 days after they gave us this DMCA, Rondassa was in Salt Lake City in court with a client of his that he was representing. Rondassa lives in Las Vegas, or he did at the time. But he was in Salt Lake City representing a different client that had nothing to do with us in court. And so because all this media buzz was around, I called up all of the media outlets there in Utah and I said, hey, our lawyer's in town. If you guys, you know, we'll give him permission to speak on our behalf. And so he ended up on like all the different channels up there. Like it just...
Complete coincidence.
Yeah, it was complete coincidence, but it just added to the story because here's you know, the lawyer of Mormon Leaks here on TV talking about it. You know what I mean? It was really powerful.
So these documents, the things you're getting are clearly coming from insiders, probably not from members of the 12. And I don't want you to reveal your sources at all.
Don't worry, we won't.
So I want to hear your speculation because, you know, if you're sitting in a meeting that close to those guys, you're on the inside. Why are so many faithful Mormons leaking this stuff to you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's a question we get a lot. First of all, we don't always know the identity of our sources.
Right.
And unless they go out of their way to tell us, people can submit things to us and we will never know. Okay. I'll say that from talking to some of the sources that I know the identity, but also talking to people who I have as sources that I have that work at the church or recently worked at the church that haven't necessarily sent me documents. There is a huge amount of people that work at the church office building that are faking it in terms of their belief in the church. And they're going through the motions every day because they have a nice pension package or, you know, whatever. They aren't very marketable because, you know, they've been doing something for the church for 20 years that no other business does. And so they can't, like, just go out and get another job making the same amount of money. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of winking and nodding going in the hallways and from what I've been told by many people.
I will confirm as a resident of Salt Lake City who knows some people. Yes, there are lots of them. They're all over the place.
And it's a tinderbox that it's, you know, you're bound to strike a few matches at some point. And really, if they don't have a huge revolt or like a massive leak at some point, they're going to be lucky. Like, I would expect it to happen, you know, at some point, just because the numbers are on the side of it happening.
Well, and stuff has been leaking, you know, not at the speed and acuity that you guys are, but since the church has been around, which is why the church has detectives. This is why the church has all sorts of, you know, that they're working at the church office building, unless you are a really strong true believer, is not a fun place to be. It's kind of out of an Orwellian novel.
I've had multiple people tell me that within the first week of them starting their job, they were completely disillusioned with the church.
Yeah.
You can't watch the sausage get made and keep your illusions up.
Yeah, I've heard it said that the worst thing that can happen to your testimony is working for the church.
I don't doubt it.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these Firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
All right, so we just had something. It was Sunday. We're recording this Tuesday night. It was Sunday when your latest
Monday
came in. Monday.
Monday.
Just yesterday.
Yeah. Yesterday. Yep.
Oh wow, I feel privileged. So and I do have to confess, because I've radically honest. We're recording this again because I screwed up the first one. So I do appreciate you guys coming back on. But let's what dropped on Monday?
Well, we wrote an article, and it linked back to an audio recording and some police reports that basically the a guy who most Mormons probably don't know his name, but they know things that he's done. Right. And so outside of the church, he's known as the co-founder of Sundance back in the 70s with Robert Redford. His cousin, I'm blanking on her name, was married to Robert Redford for 30 years and has four kids with Robert Redford, his cousin. And so that's kind of how he knows Robert Redford. He's a filmmaker. He one of his films brought an Oscar for Best Actress back in the 80s. He's done a lot of documentary work, and he's worked as a professor at BYU in the film department.
You're in these circles, this is Sterling Van Wagenen.
Van Wagenen, yeah.
He is extremely well known. He's a church insider. He's an uppity up. He's at BYU. He's the go-to guy for church media. And probably, you know, the church ambassadors people out all the time in an official capacity. And he's been one of those guys.
But the average sort of, you know, chapel Mormon doesn't necessarily recognize the name. But like you said, the people that are paying attention, and especially people who are involved in like LDS cinema or follow it closely. He was, for example, he was the executive producer. Well, he was the director on two, I think, of the Work in the Glory movies, which were produced by one of the church's for-profit companies. And recently on that Jane and Emma movie that came out last year, he was the executive producer. That also was a church project under one of their for-profit companies. But more importantly than all of that, in my mind, is he was the director of the three temple movies that were circulating in the temple up until January.
Yeah. So these are the ones that were remade in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
I have to confess, I have never seen them. So
neither have I.
I have.
Are they fantastic?
Nope.
Do they still have naked chicks running around in there? I mean, not anymore. Not after January. But anyway, I divert. So yeah. Yes, and I know you guys probably don't have anything necessary to say about this, but it strikes me as strange that those movies get pulled exactly 3 weeks before this hits.
Well, we can let's come back to that. Let's circle back to that. But so we have this guy Sterling Van Wagenen on tape. The tape was made last year, where he is admitting to having molested a 13-year-old boy.
And when you say last year, you mean just barely in September of 2018.
Correct. That's when he was
a whole year ago.
Yeah. That's when he was taped. Now the abuse occurred in 1993.
So let's back up a second. You're using the pseudonym David for this individual who is victimized by Van Wagenen when David was 13 years old, which was in 1993, I believe.
Which is also the same year that he was hired by BYU to be a professor in the film department.
So David called Van Wagenen, mm-hmm. I guess on the phone in the fall a few months ago.
No, that's not what happened.
So where did the tape come from first? I think that's...
It came from David.
And where? How did he get it?
Well, he made it. He's on the tape.
Okay, but it was a conversation between him and Van Wagenen. I have not looked at the tape.
Okay, so the way I understand it from dealing with David for the last 2 or 3 months is that he's been dealing with this trauma his whole life by himself basically, if you talk to the guy or you meet him, he's actually a very well adjusted family man, like on the surface, but when this comes up. He completely changes. You could just tell this has affected him his entire life. And he eventually, I guess at some point, again, I don't know all the details, but I'm 99% accurate on how this kind of went down.
Okay. I have to issue the obligatory trigger warning. Okay. For the next 2 minutes, we're going to talk about what happened with David here.
Yeah, maybe a little longer than that, but yeah. So he reached out to one or more of Sterling's kids who he was still in touch with.
Okay.
Because the abuse happened while he was at a sleepover because he was friends with Sterling's kids. And he told his kid for the first time, your dad did this to me and I just don't have closure. And from what I understand, the kid that he spoke to was very supportive, confronted Sterling, and Sterling admitted to it. And then brokered a meeting between the two, a one-on-one meeting with
now,
these.
Let's go ahead and say, and we can define it in kind of broad terms. When he was 13, he was at a sleepover. David woke up in the night and found Van Wagenen molesting him on his genitals.
Correct. And he jumped up and ran into the bathroom and locked himself in the bathroom for the rest of the night.
Right. The boy did. David did.
The boy did. Correct.
And that was his last contact really with him. But of course that
well, sexual contact. I mean, they were in the same ward.
Oh yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
So obviously perpetrated rape, molested as a young boy, and something he's going to carry and deal with forever. So that's the background of what happened here.
Right. And so the child, of Sterling, who David had contacted, brokers this meeting, from what I understand, this one-on-one meeting with the goal of helping David finally get some closure. And they were going to hash it out, the two of them. And to David's surprise, Sterling agreed to go to David's house and meet with him. And he didn't know what to expect, how Sterling was going to react at all. So he hits the record button.
Mm.
And much to his surprise, Sterling basically opened up the book of his life and read from it. I mean, I have never heard a more complete and thorough confessions of one's life sins, than this one.
Has there been anybody who pushes back and says that's not really Sterling?
Well, all you have to do is go to YouTube. There's a bunch of interviews with Sterling on YouTube. the voice is identical. And Sterling issued a statement to us, which we have at the bottom of the article. He says that he repented and did everything he needed to do to be right with whatever.
To answer your question directly, though, yes, there are people that have denied that this could possibly be true.
Yeah, there's somebody... Somebody put on our Facebook page, they said, I know Sterling. There's no way this is true. This is fake news or something like that. So
Sterling is obviously an individual. What we've outlined so far is criminal and terrible and reprehensible.
Correct.
But that's not why you guys are doing it. So let's talk about what happens next, because the crime is always in the cover-up.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, David goes to his parents immediately. His parents go to a mutual friend who at the time was a bishop of a singles ward, but was living in the same, you know, stake or whatever, and was a mutual friend of both David's parents and Sterling. And this mutual friend says to Sterling, hey, I'm telling the stake president about this, you know. And the stake president, within a day or two, calls Sterling in, and Sterling says in the tape that he made a full confession, went through a council, and was given 2 years disfellowship. Now, the stake president also encouraged him to go to the police, which he did. We have those police reports, and the police declined to press charges because the parents said to the police, we support Sterling in his efforts to get help, and we don't want to press charges. Now, David tells us, we don't have this corroborated, but David tells us that this mutual friend, this bishop, encouraged his parents to allow the church to handle it. Okay. Which I don't know. Again, we don't know if that's true or if he's, you know, misremembering it or whatever, but I think we can all agree that that's within the realm of possibilities. Like, it's not out of this world to imagine that having happened. He goes on. We don't know if he was hired by BYU before or after the abuse, but it was in the same year. And, you know, David says he was never contacted by the stake president to see if he was okay, if he needed any kind of therapy. The stake president was a man named Harold Brown, which people can look this guy up. At the time of this confession, he was the commissioner of LDS families, of LDS social services. He was the top dog in the arm of the church that should be dealing with this exact type of thing.
So, I mean, not only was that his, you know, kind of professional duty, mm-hmm. but he knows better. There's no hiding from, he knew exactly what was going on. He knew exactly how child molesters do. And, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to lay accusations that where I don't have any evidence, but oftentimes it's rare to have one victim.
Well, yeah, and that gets brought up in the tape. You know, Sterling vehemently denies that there's ever been a – you know, he admits that he's cheated on his wife with prostitutes and other people, men and women, but vehemently denies that it was – that there's ever been any children. And that's possible, but we all know that statistically that's improbable. Right. And on paper, David hit the jackpot in terms of leadership roulette. He should have been – he was in a position to be taken care of better than any other victim like this. And not only was he not offered the care he needed, Sterling went on to enjoy what I think most Mormons would consider privileged and prestigious employment with the church. You know, it's not like he went to become the janitor. You know, he went on to enjoy this prestigious career, which culminated in him directing these three – temple videos, like the most sacred videos in Mormonism, I assume.
And let me say this, I was alive and an adult in 1993. This mm-hmm. wasn't 1956. Mm-hmm. In 1993, the problem of child abuse and molestation, and even in the church, was well known. There were, you know, there were firesides and trainings. This was not like the past when everything was swept under the rug. Of course, it still was, and it still is today. But the church and the people knew better. They can't plead that they were just a product of the time.
Well, and one of the questions is, did the church know about this confession and give him employment anyway? And we don't really know. But what I can tell you from my research into this story, I spoke to probably eight different people who had were all either former bishops or stake presidents, okay? And I asked them about this process of being disfellowshipped. And they all told me the same thing. They said, if you go through a court, a disciplinary council, and you are formally disfellowshipped, like Sterling says he was, if proper procedures are followed, there is a paper trail that ends up with an annotation being on your church record at church office building.
Yes. So and I have experience with this, not being on the victim side or the perpetrator side. Mm-hmm. What the record says at the bottom is called to church office. Mm-hmm. And it's been the church's policy that anybody who engages in any homosexual activity gets that annotation. Mm-hmm. Even if it's completely consensual or with adults, or if it's been repented from 40 years ago, the church policy is that they get that on there. So it should have been on his records.
Right. Now, we shouldn't. Now, even though the church, I believe, messed up in many ways in this story, we need to make sure that we are concise in what we're accusing the church of. We don't actually know, even though we all know that's the procedures, we don't know that the church gave him employment while he had this annotation on his record, because it is possible that Harold Brown, the stake president, didn't follow proper procedure. Now, either way, it's messed up. But we don't know if Harold Brown independently did messed up or if the church as an organization did. Either way, the system is broken. It's broken.
And that's where the real story is that we were trying to promote here, excuse me, is that the story is not necessarily that Van Wagenen molested David, right? The story is that the church completely failed David. The church, the system, as Ryan said, is completely broken. Van Wagenen went on to have a very privileged Mormon life, and David went on to be traumatized the rest of his life without any help or counseling, right? That, if that is not broken, I don't know what is.
Thank you for bringing that up. I mean, because I tend to, you know, reserve my anger for the institution and the things that happened there. And you're right, that David here is the victim and continues to be the victim. And I think for a lot of us, he represents thousands of other kids who, you know, there's horror stories. I've met people directly who were basically molested and then excommunicated, disfellowshipped themselves. women close to me who were yelled at by bishops for, you know, after sleeping with their boyfriend or whatever, for tempting, you know, like, it's just this wake of victimhood is it's just hard to deal with.
You know, as we were going through this, at one point I was talking to Ethan on the phone as we were, you know, researching the story and prepping the story. And I said, you know what? I said that Believer documentary that, Dan Reynolds from Imagine Dragons did last year. I don't know if you've seen that, John, or not. But in that documentary, he reveals that he was kicked out of BYU for having had sex with his girlfriend.
Right.
So here we've got a guy, and he's not obviously the only case. Like you said, I mean, we there's stories like this all over the place. But I said to Ethan, I said, look, Dan Reynolds is kicked out of BYU for having sex with his girlfriend, and Sterling Van Wagenen is given a job.
And given more and more increasing responsibility. It's just sad. And you know, what's sad is the same thing we see going on in the Catholic Church. And today, thank goodness, the Pope finally said that the Catholic Church has a problem with priests molesting nuns. We're not even talking about little boys. We're talking about priests molesting nuns. And the Catholic Church is finally acknowledging it. So we're not going to proceed as humanity until these institutions that have power over us stop treating us like cattle. I don't know any better way to say it.
And the change, amen. Go ahead, Ethan.
I was just going to say amen. And that's exactly what that is. Our mission is to promote that idea that you just said.
And the change needs to start at the bottom. All change, almost every major change in the church, we can trace to some sort of grassroots movement. And I really hope that stories like this, that where there's like almost no wiggle room for a Mormon to sort of justify what happened I mean, there is, you know, they'll always find that crack that they can squeeze through, but it's very small in this case. And we hope that stories like this can help Mormons take a step back and realize, okay, yeah, Ryan, he's an ex-Mormon, but maybe he isn't the devil. Maybe he is actually trying to, you know, just say it like it is. Because what often happens with these stories that we put out there, these leaks that we put out there, they get – people don't even read them. They just say, oh, Mormon leaks, it's, you know, it's just anti-Mormon material. No, none of this has to do with the church being true or not. This has to do with real problems that need to be addressed, and you can address them while still saying the church is true. We don't want people to stop saying the church is true if that's really what they have their heart set on, okay? As long as they don't tell me I have to say it, I'm fine with that. But you still have to address the problems, and we need this to happen.
Agreed. And that's why I'm passionate about talking about things like this. I think a lot of ex-Mormons, whoever, are characterized unfairly as just being agitators, just wanting to cause suffering. But, you know, for me, I take the Amnesty International model. I remember reading something that they'd published years ago, and they said, you know, when people who are stuck in prison or stuck in terrible conditions, when the letters start coming in, when the captors see that people are paying attention, then their conditions improve. And they say, we may not ever get these people released, but you know, when, if you're in some prison in Myanmar or something, and there's 1,000 letters coming in, they might feed you a little bit better because they know the world's watching. And I think that's I feel a moral responsibility to help expose this stuff for the Davids out there. And of course, I feel great sympathy for David, but even more so for all the silent ones, and even more so for the ones who never made it, who took their own lives because of stuff like this. And it happens all the time.
Yeah, and people need to take a step back, self-examine, get perspective. With the exception of probably like 2 leaks that we've had, this being one of them, every single thing that we have leaked can be seen from a faithful perspective. Every single one, except for maybe 2. So stop being afraid of these things. Read them. Have an original thought. Enjoy what it is you enjoy. Praise what it is you think is worth praising. And call out what needs to be called out. Don't excuse. I'm seeing comments online with this Sterling thing. Well, what was the church supposed to do? Well, how about provide therapy for David? How about not give Sterling Van Wagenen all of these nice cushy jobs in Salt Lake City? Okay. How about we start there?
Okay. You know, when I was on my mission, the church flew a representative from Salt Lake City who gave us a 3-hour long training on how to drive the Toyota Corollas. Okay. So yeah, let's start. What does the church do? Well, if you're going to serve as a bishop, you have to go to at least an 8-hour in-service training. It can be online. It can be whatever. The church needs to have hotlines established, not just for bishops and stake presidents, but for any church member. The church needs to have a way for members who are faithful members to report that there's problems with their stake president or with their bishop. They need to have legitimate feedback channels. The church needs to bone up the number of therapists it has. The church needs to enforce a policy that says, stake president, if you get a call from a 13-year-old who is molested by an adult who's serving in any position of authority, you will be excommunicated if you don't call this number in 2 hours. And I'm just making stuff up off the top of my head. Right?
Well, sure. And let's apply this to Sterling's case. You know, some people say, well, you know, BYU maybe never knew about it. Yeah. How come Harold Brown, the stake president, didn't call up BYU and say, I just had one of your brand new employees confess to child molestation? Why did that call not happen?
Right. Right.
Don't get me started on this, John.
let alone this poor 13-year-old boy who's left on his own. I mean, you guys brought up that point. We kind of glossed over it. The church had a moral responsibility. And I hope, I've said this many times before, I'm sorry I'm on a rant, that the people who are believers in the church, they better hope there's no such thing as heaven. Because I would guess that 90% of the bishops and stake presidents who have walked by information of this, and I'm really using a figure that high, that if you have a 13-year-old child come to you who has this, you have a moral responsibility to help that child. and that they did nothing for him is outrageous. And it's immoral, and it's disgusting. And whatever the church does, and this is the problem the Catholic Church is facing now, the good that they do in the world is tainted by these cover-ups and these victims that are out there. And it's outrageous. They are us. David is us. And we have to take care of these people.
And a lot of times when these stories come out, all the members of the church, they want to focus on the fact that, oh, well, the church could not have prevented that abuse. And that's not what you or I are saying. And in fact, we reported in our story that David does not blame the church for having been abused because they didn't, but it's the reaction, like you said, you know, it's the cover up after the fact. And a lot of those suggestions that you made of, you know, more training, all that kind of stuff, I mean, that would be a great start. But really, John, in order for there to be real change, don't you think they have to go to a paid clergy model, professional clergy? Because at the end of the day, I don't care how much how many eight-hour seminars you go to, if you're the local dentist or you're the local orthodontist and you're the bishop, you're still the local dentist or orthodontist.
And there's models for this. I mean, to go back to the Catholic Church again, there's not enough ordained priests. So we have lots of deacons and other folks who are not trained. They haven't been to seminary. They probably had gone through some training, but they serve under the auspice of the diocese. So the LDS Church could easily implement such a model that hey, sure, as soon as you get one of these bishop that you're serving, you just push them up to the church. So there's plenty of religions around that deal with these issues. The church has been behind almost every other organization in terms of protecting children, making sure there's leadership, making sure that people are trained. You know, the church gets really concerned about whether or not I pay a full tithing, but they could easily do a background check to see if somebody's a sexual a registered sex offender. They choose not to. They still choose not to.
Hey, John, can I? You just said something, and it just triggered a thought of mine. Can I provide a little bit of levity to this conversation?
Please.
You mentioned about the tithing. I have to read this email that we got today.
Oh, great!
It's about this case. Okay. We get crazy emails all the time, by the way. Crazy emails. We get an email today. And again, this shows where priorities are just not where they need to be among members. This is some Mormon who read our article and is very, very concerned about an inaccuracy, so they claim, in our story. Okay. I'm going to read this to you.
Oh, great.
If you are going to tell a story, that's the subject. It's a very short email. Okay. If you are going to tell a story, tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. By the way, when I first read that line, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, what did we get wrong? I seriously had that thought in my mind, by the way. Okay. Don't try to make the church look bad because a member of the church is unworthy and does evil things. When you are disfellowshipped, you are not allowed, and I repeat it loud and clear, you are not allowed to pay your tithing. Please make that correction in your writing. Now, they're referring to a quote that we included about what disfellowship is, where it says that they may pay their tithing. But that quote was directly from LDS.org.
Right.
And so here was my response to them. I said, thank you for the email. We take accuracy in our articles very seriously. The quote in the article comes from the following Ensign article, and then I linked to it, which we linked to it in the article too. She probably just didn't realize it. And then I said, additionally, on page 109 of the Church Handbook of Instructions, number 1, and I linked to it online because that's out of there online, it says that disfellowshipped members are encouraged to pay tithing. So here's a person who has their facts completely wrong, right? They say that you're not allowed to pay tithing when you're disfellowshipped. Not only are you allowed to, according to the Church Handbook of Instructions, you're encouraged to. But of all the things that they're upset about in this article, like even if we had gotten that wrong, that's what they're upset about.
Well, I'll add my two bits in here. The church does have a policy that if you've been excommunicated, you're not allowed to pay tithing. But I will say this, and I have read far and wide in church doctrine and history. I only know of one instance where a member of the 12 apostles has actively encouraged people to not obey a church policy. That is Spencer W. Kimball in the book Miracle Forgiveness. He goes at length to explain how to override that system and tells a story of a man who was excommunicated but still paid his tithing by handing it to his mother. He was laundering the money to give to God through his mother. It's the only time I know of where people are actively encouraged to break the rules of the church.
Sure, yeah.
you're absolutely right. Well,
I thought that was a funny email, so people hopefully will enjoy that.
Again, I apologize for getting a little heated there, but
I loved it.
But this is why I really appreciate what you guys are doing. You know, I don't at this stage in my faith journey, I don't take any pleasure in pointing out the flaws and warts in the church. You know, there's a lot of great people who are trying the best they can do to make it work. There's a lot of great things the church does. And I make sound like people are trying to make it work. It works for a lot of people. They live a better life. They live a richer life because of the church. I'm not going to argue that point. But what you guys are doing is helping to help people like David and the others that we don't have voice on. And for that, I personally thank you too.
Well, I'll let Ethan throw something in here too as the end, but I appreciate those kind words. I hope that we're doing a net good, you know, we're trying to do good. And we enjoy the conversations that are generated from our content. And I want to say a thank you to you, John. I'm glad that you're back in the podcasting world. And I'll just tell you that when I was in my angry phase leaving the church, very early on, I found Mormon Expression, and I didn't know who you were or any of your panelists or anything like that, but your podcast really hit home with me, and they played an integral role in me being able to process my paradigm shift that I was going through in my life. And so, you know, you had an impact on me, and I know you've had an impact on a bunch of other people, so I want to say to you publicly, thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. I think in the end of the day, you know, those of us who are critical of the church, a lot of us seem scary, like the boogeyman. But I've met a lot of people, and I think most are motivated principally by wanting to make the world a better place and help those who need help. You know, my hope was that people would see it's not them. They're not crazy. They're not broken. And hell, most people who live on this planet find themselves in crazy circumstances. They're slaves working on the pyramids or you know, starving to death out somewhere. And we're fortunate that we have as much as we have, but we can all make the world a better place. And that's my hope. And again, I think you guys are contributing to that. So thank you so much.
Thank you, John. I think a lot of important things were said in this conversation. It was great. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, I think it was the Holy Ghost who ruined the first tape, because I think we did a lot better this time.
Yeah, well, let Ethan, you know, I want Ethan to give some final thoughts, because I kind of talked over him a lot this episode. So he has a lot to say, too, and he has his own passion. So, you know, I know that he's got strong feelings about what we do, too. So give him a minute to kind of give a closing statement there.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. I think, John, you summed up a lot of my feelings. The church and just religion in general has such a hold on so many people's lives that they forget to critically analyze what it is they're doing, what it is they're supporting, right? And it's just so important for people to be able to make an informed decision. Part of my motivation is actually people like my grandparents, and I'm sure some of my faithful cousins are going to be listening to this, and they're going to go crazy that I'm using our grandparents as motivation here. But my grandparents are wonderful, wonderful people, right? They've given their entire lives to the church, right? They're so faithful. They've given so much money. They've given 10% and then some. They were the first missionaries in Mongolia, right? They gave up so much of their lives to the church, and that's fine. But they did so without knowing where that money was going. They did so, in my opinion, uninformed or misinformed in some situations, right? And that really hurts me. People need to know and be informed about what they are supporting, and that is what motivates me to do what we're doing.
Well, fantastic. I think that's a great place to leave it. Well, I hope to see you guys this summer. If you're coming on up to Sunstone Conference.
Yeah, we'll probably be there.
Well, fantastic. Gentlemen, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you both. Thanks again.
Thanks, John.